Hello and welcome to a podcast about murder. I'm Freya and I'm here again with Jem to talk about murder. How are you doing on this fine day, my friend?
Pretty good. Weather's not great, but...
No, it's cold here as well.
Some of that hot weather convo you guys tune in for.
It's also like last week I said about how warm it was getting and I feel like I've been punished for saying that. But anyway, you ready to talk about murder today? Let's get to it.
I'm excited about this case because I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, so today's case is an interesting one because this was a last minute switcheroo. I had a different case lined up for this episode, but then someone commented on not last episode, but the episode before requesting this case. And I hadn't heard the name, so I looked it up and I immediately found it interesting. So I took the unusual step of swapping out what I was originally going to do for episode 5 and choosing to do this case instead. One of the main things that compelled me about this case was the potential wrongful conviction involved, which is an aspect that I always find pretty interesting to discuss. It's also a case that remains unsolved, and I just thought we hadn't done a case like this in quite a while. So I thought, let's do it. There was a lot more to this than I thought as well. It's quite a winding road with a lot of detail, and I really had an interesting time looking into this. I've gone back and forth on what I think happened here about 10 times since I started writing, so if it seems like I'm on one side and then the next as we go through, that's because I am. So anyway, thank you to Vivian, our commenter, for bringing this case, the murder of Billie Jo Jenkins, to my attention. Before we get into it, this episode deals with a violent murder committed against a child, so bear that in mind before we continue. Billie Jo Jenkins was born on the 29th of March 1983 and raised in East London. Unfortunately, tragedy struck Billie Jo's life early on when her father Bill was sent to prison. I'm unclear for what. We can assume that Billie Jo's early home life when she lived with Bill and her mum Debbie wasn't plain sailing, but there aren't too many details that I felt passed my threshold for a reasonable assumption of truth. So I felt it would be a bit unfair to include things about Billie Jo's family that paint them in a harsh light if I couldn't verify they were 100% true. So for that reason, I've left out some of the details about this early part of her life. And, you know, you're all free to look up and see what you think about those things. Regardless, for whatever reason, Billie Jo's mother, Debbie, felt she couldn't cope after Bill was sent to prison, and Billie Jo was placed in foster care at the age of 9. It's believed that Debbie at least believed this to be a temporary arrangement. So basically, I'm just saying I don't want to badmouth Debbie too much, and I don't want to say she was like a bad mum or make it seem like... I think she thought she was doing the best thing for her kid, right? So yeah, I'm just going to say that. A home was found for Billie Jo with married couple Sean...
What's happening?
Sorry. His name is Sean, but it's written S-I-O-N, which is the Welsh spelling of Sean. So I just tripped up there because I'd written married couple Sean, brackets pronounced Sean. So I just tripped up there. And Lois Jenkins was his wife. It was a complete coincidence that Billie Jo and her new foster parents shared the same last name, Jenkins. Sean, a deputy head teacher, and Lois, a social worker, had 4 daughters of their own. Annie, Lottie, Esther, and Maya, all aged between 7 and 12 at the time. Annie's the oldest, Maya's the youngest. So that in that order. Lois, whose own parents had fostered children, liked the idea of sharing their home with a foster child who needed it. Billie Jo Jenkins was described as an outgoing girl who was very fun to be around. Although she had sometimes struggled with her behaviour and at school, most understood this to be related to the instability of her home life. Eventually, she settled into her new home with the Jenkins family in the seaside town of Hastings, East Sussex, on the south coast of England, and started at a new school. 4 years passed, and those around Billie Jo would say she seemed happy to have embarked on a fresh start in a new town. She was doing well academically and had made new friends and enjoyed spending time by the sea and in a large park, which was just across from their home. Like any teenager, especially one who had been fostered by a new family, there were tough times for Billie Joe, but overall, it was said, things were going well for her. February 15th, 1997 was a Saturday. Billie Joe Jenkins, now 13, was home painting the French windows at the back of the house. Her foster mother, Lois, had taken the youngest two children, Esther and Maya, out with her that day. Lottie, the second eldest daughter, was at a clarinet lesson, while father Sean and eldest daughter Annie stayed home with Billie Joe. Sean would state that when Lottie's clarinet lesson finished in the afternoon, he took Annie with him to pick her up in the car at 3 p.m. When Sean returned with Lottie and Annie, he decided to go back out to the shops with the two girls to pick up some white spirit. Billie Joe's painting had resulted in some splashes of paint that needed to be cleaned up. Lottie and Annie did not go inside the house between those two trips. So they arrive back home from the clarinet lesson, and only Sean goes inside.
Right.
For about 3 minutes, and then he comes back out, and then they go to the shops.
Did he say beforehand, before getting out of the car, did he say that they were going to the shops? Because why were they staying in the car? What was the reason for that?
So I think before he had... This is a bit confusing, and this is why some people would say this story is a little bit odd. It's not known when he made the decision to go, but he must have made the decision that he was going back out before he arrived home. Otherwise, the daughters would have gone straight into the house.
Yeah. But then also, if he'd made that decision before arriving at the house, you wouldn't have gone
to the
house.
Why didn't he go in the one trip?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's something to bear in mind. So around 20 minutes it took for Sean and his two daughters to go to the shops and to return again. But notably, they returned without any white spirit because Sean had left his money behind.
Right.
So that's another sort of strange element to that story. Entering the dining room, Lottie was confronted with the awful sight of her foster sister Billie Joe's body lying in a pool of blood. She called for her dad, and Sean immediately called 999 to report that his foster daughter had been attacked. But although that's not what he said was, "My daughter's fallen or she's got head injuries. There's blood everywhere. She's on the floor." He stated that she was not breathing.
Okay.
The autopsy showed that Billie Joe had been beaten to death with an 18-inch tent peg made of metal, which was left beside her body. This is like a really vicious attack that she's suffered. Yeah. Top of her skull is badly fractured, resulting in severe injuries to her brain. Billie Joe had been struck at least 6 times to her head. Bizarrely, a piece of plastic bag was found lodged inside of her nose. And it was said to be part of a black bin bag. So that's an odd element.
Is the thought that she was suffocated somehow?
No, it's more like this piece of plastic bag was intentionally taken forcibly placed up her nose very deeply.
That is strange.
In a sort of ritualistic thing. The tent peg used in the murder had apparently been left outside in the garden after being one of many items cleared out from storage. So although I'm not clear exactly where it came from, this single tent peg, it does seem like an odd weapon.
Yeah.
It was said to have been something that was in the vicinity of where she was painting, and it just happened to be there. Right.
Okay.
As the investigation began, Billie Joe's foster parents, Sean and Lois, appealed to the public for information. Police had a few leads to start with early on in the case. Firstly was the rumours revealed to investigators by Billie Joe's friends that in the weeks leading up to the murder, Billie Joe had talked to her peers about being followed by someone. Police were never able to establish who this person might have been if Billie Joe was indeed being followed. The lead failed to turn up any further clues and was abandoned. Secondly, there were sightings reported to police of a man spotted in the area on the day of the murder. This man was said to have mental health issues and apparently had a fetish-like interest in plastic bags, which offered an obvious connection with the findings of Billie Joe's autopsy. The man's behaviour when sighted around the time of the killing was said to be obviously disturbed. However, police managed to track down the man for questioning and established that he had an alibi. This man would become known as Mr. B and much later as Mr. X, and we'll get back into him later.
Okay.
Finally, police turned their attention to the man who would become the prime suspect in the case, Sean Jenkins, Billy Joe's foster father. Investigators had their suspicions about Sean from the start, and their doubts about his story mounted when his own wife Lois came to them to reveal a secret violent side of her husband. Mm-hmm. Accusations that he had beaten both his wife Lois and Billy Joe painted a picture of a potential beating that may have escalated to murder. Lois would years later reveal that she had come to suspect Sean within days of Billy Joe's murder, saying, "I woke up in the middle of the night as he turned over in bed, and it dawned on me that it could have been him. I lay there terrified, thinking it must be him, and if it wasn't him, at least it could have been him."
Mm.
I'm sorry if there's beeping. There's a really annoying beeping sound. I'm sorry if that comes through. Sean was arrested relatively soon after the murder and charged, with police working on the theory that Sean had killed Billy Joe in the 3-minute window between the trip to pick up Lottie and the trip to the shops to fetch White Spirit. They believed the second trip was taken to create an alibi, and found the sudden need to fetch White Spirit bizarre and unconvincing, especially considering that a search of the house had turned up a bottle of White Spirit, so he had White Spirit.
Mm.
Whether he knew this or not, obviously, you know, I might not know that I had another bottle of washing up liquid and go out and get one. That's happened to me before.
Yeah.
So, not to mention the fact that he had left his money behind at the house and not actually gotten any White Spirit in the end anyway.
Well,
so
the
they
thing.
Just found this whole thing a bit unconvincing.
It's also like, I would buy going to pick up an extra bottle of something you already have as part of a trip to get other things. But to specifically go out and get that one thing without checking or knowing beforehand whether you have some or not seems strange.
Sean's daughters Lottie and Annie had also told police that on the way back from the trip, their father had taken an unusual route. They said that he'd circled around the park 2 times. This suggested to police that Sean was trying to extend the trip, perhaps to create a better alibi or a longer window of time for a potential other killer to break in.
Yeah.
There is also the very sad and disturbing possibility that he knew that the quick attack had left Billy Joe clinging to life and that he was leaving time for her succumb to her injuries, ensuring that she couldn't survive to name him as her attacker.
I mean, that's so horrific. I hadn't even considered that would be part of it, but I mean,
it's
it makes
a
sense.
Possibility. We'll get more into whether Billy Joe was alive when Sean and his daughters returned later, as that forms part of the case. At trial, the prosecution laid out their case against Sean, from their suspicions about the shopping trip to questioning his behaviour as Billy Joe's body was discovered, mainly that he had not attempted CPR.
Mm.
They also laid out their physical evidence. Examination of Sean's clothing by forensic technicians had revealed microscopic spots of blood on items including his jacket, trousers and shoes. 2 forensic experts who would later be called on at trial believed that the pattern of the spots indicated blood spatter, and that it could only have been transferred to Sean's clothing if he had been the one who had killed Billy Joe. To be clear, we're talking about blood that could not be seen by the naked eye.
Okay.
So I'll say about this, although we'll get into our thoughts on the evidence a bit later, why is there so little blood if these are the clothes that he was wearing, which is what they're going with?
Yeah.
They're not saying he changed. They're saying this is the blood from
the attack.
This is a vicious beating about the head, which we know will have a tendency to bleed a lot. Apologies for being graphic. But there's only this microscopic mist of blood on his clothing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That seems odd.
Also, I was thinking about the CPR. It's like, I don't know what kind of knowledge he has, but typically if a person has suffered a head trauma, you don't attempt CPR in case of like further injury.
Well, you've actually done a CPR course, haven't you?
Because I haven't. Well, it depends if they're conscious or not, I guess. If she's unconscious, you should sort of intervene. So I don't know. But also, in the heat of the moment, I don't know if I'd feel confident attempting CPR on someone who was like, I don't even know if I would think of it.
Yeah.
To be quite honest.
I don't know what I would do. I mean, like, a similar thing. I actually have no idea how I would react. The defense claimed the blood had been transferred to Sean's clothing when he cradled the body of Billy Joe after discovering her. However, it was pointed out that the ambulance crew did not have a similar pattern of blood on their clothing, even though they had also been in contact with the body. The prosecution added another angle. Experts believed that if the blood had been transferred to Sean in an innocent way, such as if he had cradled the body, the only other way the pattern could have been replicated is if Billy Joe were breathing heavily, giving out a similar spray pattern. But the prosecution reminded the jury that Sean had stated himself in the 999 call that Billy Joe was not breathing.
It is possible that he hadn't noticed she was breathing, if she's breathing very faintly.
Yes, and that will come up as well. On July the 2nd, 1998, Sean Jenkins was found guilty and convicted of the murder of his foster daughter, Billy Joe. The judge handed down a life sentence. Lois Jenkins left her husband, moving with their children to Tasmania, about as far away as you can get from Hastings.
I wasn't expecting it to be that far.
But who could blame her, no matter what went down, I guess. It was just too much.
To be honest, I could see Tasmania as being, a great option.
Meanwhile, Sean Jenkins professed his innocence. His appeal for a retrial was at first unsuccessful in the following year, 1999. But in 2004, a retrial was granted. There would actually be two retrials, and both would fail to result in a verdict. The retrials focused around re-examining the blood evidence in the case and presenting another suspect, the mysterious Mr. B. On the blood evidence, one forensic expert, a Mr. McCurdy, had made his reservations about the supposed blood spatter known at the time of the original trial, but he had not been called to give evidence. He believed that spatter from striking a victim in the way that Billy Joe was killed would have produced a different pattern, one that contained multiple differently sized drops. The spots on Sean's clothing were very uniform in size. This suggested, according to the experts consulted, that the blood had instead been aspirated onto Sean's clothing by Billy Joe as she clung to life. Although Sean had told 999 that Billy Joe was not breathing, as you said, he could have been mistaken. Her breathing could have been very slow and shallow as she neared death, and it could have been difficult to detect by sight or sound, especially as Sean was shaken by the dramatic scene, presumably.
Yeah. I was also wondering if just by moving a body, if he's cradling her, it would force some air out of her mouth, for example.
Yeah, that's a good point as well.
But I don't know how anatomy works.
A number of fresh experts were called to the second trial in Sean's defense to give evidence on this theory. Tests conducted in the lab had shown that blood could be transferred in a similar way through a victim's nose as it filled with blood. The defense argued that the prosecution's version of events had not been sufficiently proven by this evidence. And I think that's fair.
I would agree with that. It seems like not enough evidence to be sure.
Yeah. Another angle brought up in the second trial was a spate of break-ins in the area near where the Jenkins family lived. The break-ins had left the Jenkins as well as other families in the area concerned. The Jenkins family reportedly had outdoor lighting and window locks installed and got a dog in response to their security worries. Many reports of unsavory characters loitering near the house, particularly between late 1996 and Billy Joe's death in early 1997, were brought up to offer another explanation. A random attack by a stranger who had been watching the family. This, coupled with the rumours that Billy Joe felt she was being followed and accounts from Billy Joe's friends about strange phone calls to the family's house, suggested the possibility that someone had been stalking her. The defence honed in on early suspect Mr. B as the real killer, arguing that the murder suggested a perpetrator who was mentally deranged. Witnesses were called to give evidence about seeing Mr. B in the neighbourhood and their impressions of his behaviour, which many found unsettling or even frightening. This included incidents revolving around Mr. B touching his nose and holding plastic bags, which the defence linked with the discovery of the piece of plastic in Billy Joe's nose.
Right. That is an odd detail that doesn't fit with Sean Jenkins as a suspect.
Totally. Police officers reported that when they tried to arrest Mr. B after the murder, he became violent. During the retrials, the recorded statements given by Annie and Lottie to police were used as evidence by both sides. Lottie, who discovered Billy Joe's body, believed that the side gate on the property, which led into a small alleyway between the Jenkins house and the next, was open when they got back. According to her, the gate was closed when they had left, which the defence said suggested someone may have entered and exited from there. The suspect could easily have disappeared from there into the park across the street after the attack, and this is literally across the street. Like, I looked at it on Google Maps and it's like,
oh, right, okay.
The park is there, and then it's the one side of their street is the park, and right. The other side is. So it's pretty close. You could abscond to the park, yeah. And into the trees, which there are many of, and possibly not be seen. Meanwhile, Annie's statements that her father Sean had gone through the events with her after they had discovered the body were seized on by the prosecution as evidence that Sean had coached his daughter on what to say.
Mm. How old is she at this point?
Annie is the oldest. She's 12 at the time.
Okay.
So the theories, at least as far as the trials are concerned, seem to silo off into two main explanations. Either Sean is the killer, mm. or this Mr. B is the killer. I think there are other options that I feel we can rule out. There was no evidence to suggest a sexual crime, at least in the traditional sense. Mm. There was no evidence that suggested a burglary either. A potential burglar would have had to have been immediately startled upon entry by Billy's being in the home unexpectedly and viciously beaten her to death or near death and then left without taking anything.
Yeah, that doesn't seem...
It could be possible, but if they didn't expect to kill her and they just done so in the heat of the moment,
well,
adrenaline...
Well, that's the thing. I don't think if you had done that, you would have the tent peg as the weapon of choice, because it doesn't seem like it was something on hand in the house.
She's outside painting the doors.
And that's where they found her?
This is one of those weird inconsistencies, because some sources say she was found outside, but she was, but according to the evidence that was given in court by Lottie, mm. she was found in the dining room, which I presume is the room that leads out.
Yeah.
So she would have been near the door.
Okay.
But not outside. And also Sean says she's on the floor. If she were outside, I think he would say she's on the ground.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's what I would say anyway. So I think she's found just inside the house, but like not, and I presume right. The doors are still open, like she's painting them, if you right, see what right. I mean.
Well, in that case, then the tent peg thing could be used as a weapon by an intruder.
Yes. So I do have a little bit on that in a minute that I will go back to.
Mm. But I don't think, this is the middle of the day as well. It's a bit of an unusual time for a burglary.
Definitely. It's far from the simplest explanation.
Mm.
So the theory that the motive was murder itself, or perhaps a mentally ill person in the area such as Mr. B, is more compelling because of the plastic bag link, but it's still far from a simple explanation.
Yeah.
It's statistically unlikely to be attacked by a stranger simply for the thrill of murder or for no reason at all, but mm. we do talk about crimes like that on many of our episodes, so of course it does happen.
Yeah.
The judge in the 2004 appeal trial stated of Mr. B, "It seems implausible that he could have walked from the park to the scene of the killing unobserved, arrived during the small window of opportunity and time, entered apparently occupied premises, and bludgeoned a girl with whom he is not shown to have any connection for no reason. There is no evidence that he killed her." That's what the judge said. Mm. Some people would disagree with that. But
this is the thing. If we believe that she was being watched in the days leading up to her murder, then there is a connection.
Right.
So
I think he's just saying there's no shown, like there's yeah. no, we can show a connection between them. I will mention as well, just that a mentally ill person is far more likely to be the victim of violence than the perpetrator. And although Mr. B had suspected paranoid schizophrenia, it's a misconception that schizophrenic people are typically violent. I just wanted to state that as like a caveat.
No, it's one of those sort of stereotypes that are perpetuated by the horror genre, that a mentally ill person will be incredibly violent and is not founded in truth.
One thing that is huge for me in the random attack theory is the murder weapon, and that's something that you were trying to get at earlier.
Mm.
This was an object from inside the home, but by inside the home I mean on the property. I guess a suspect with mental health issues might not have a very planned out idea of what they're going to do when they enter the property,
yeah.
and may have opportunistically grabbed the tent peg. Maybe they were expecting to have a different encounter with Billy Joe than they eventually did. Whatever is going on in their mind. Mm. However, it does seem odd that someone who was looking to harm someone and who was stalking the family would not have brought something with them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, that you don't bring your own weapon to a crime is strange.
And then they leave the weapon there. You know, it's just that, I don't know. And in other cases, you find that investigators often say a weapon from within the home points to a person from that home as a more likely suspect. If it sounds like I'm trying to turn suspicion back on Sean Jenkins and refute the claims of another perpetrator, I'm not necessarily. I do think it could have been this Mr. B character who did this. But the truth is that you are far, far more likely, especially as a child, to be attacked or killed by someone close to you than you are to be attacked or killed by a stranger. Stranger on stranger murder is incredibly rare. For me, and I'm sure many other people, it is much easier to believe that the foster father, a rumoured physically abusive man, could have beaten Billie Jo to death. Perhaps he didn't intend to kill her. Maybe he just hit her in the moment and then it was like, oh, shit, now I have to... Who knows what the finer details were, but when we're talking just circumstance-wise, it is a far more likely explanation than the ones we've just outlined.
Yeah.
Just statistically. But then they're losing me with the actual evidence.
Yeah.
The evidence in the case is very weak against Sean, both the physical and the circumstantial evidence. There is nothing that truly compels me to be like, oh yeah, he's definitely guilty.
Yeah. It's all just a bit odd.
Right. With regards to the blood evidence, I think it's bizarre that in an attack like this, there would not be more blood on his clothes if these are the clothes that he's wearing during the crime, which is what the prosecution claims.
Well, that's the thing. I'm assuming also that his daughters would have noticed if he'd gone in the house and come out wearing different clothes.
Right. So I would have said, if it weren't for what you just said, I would have said it was more likely that if he did kill her, he changed clothes. Then these clothes he's wearing with the droplets on got that transfer later from the body in the way that the defense explains through the breathing. But where are the other clothes? And like you said, why do his kids not notice him change clothes?
Yeah. And also a tent peg isn't a big, you know, you have to get pretty close to the person.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To attack them. So you would definitely get blood on your clothing.
It would be so unlikely for you to not get way more visible blood on you. I do think it's odd that in his cradling of Billie Jo, she could have breathed blood onto his trousers and shoes as well as his jacket. But the blood that we're talking about here is minute and microscopic amounts, particles that are so tiny that they behave in ways that I probably don't understand. Like, that's, you know, true. They're carried by other forces, basically.
But I was also thinking, you know, if you walk up to her and you're standing by her head and then you kneel down.
And then you kneel down, maybe you're cross-legged, your shoes and trousers and jacket would all be exposed, I suppose. The timeline is also, like, needless to say, the timeline is also giving me a bit of trouble here because there are just 3 minutes where he could have committed
the
crime.
That's the thing I don't understand, is that it seems unlikely. In the theory that he is the murderer, it would be likely that he kills her, like, accidentally in the heat of some kind of argument, which it doesn't seem like there's enough time to happen. So for this theory to work out, he would have to go in there knowing that he's going to kill her.
Yes.
And in that case, why wouldn't you use a better weapon?
The idea that he's gone out to create an alibi as well, and he's so calm, makes it seem like, well, if he's the killer, then it has to be planned far in advance.
But then, yeah, if it is planned far in advance, you want to make it seem as random and as, like, not planned out as possible. So I'm back to, it makes sense then, to use the tent peg as a weapon.
Yes. Yeah, so 3 minutes is not a very long time to commit a murder that is extremely bloody and then go and then get outside to your waiting children without any change in your demeanor that they notice.
Yeah.
Unless there was a change in the demeanor, and we don't know this because we only have Lottie and Annie's word to rely on. So if he does coach them after, if they are protecting him because he's their dad, maybe there was a change in demeanor. The only explanation I could think of is in the moment he sees that the paint is a mess. And he's angry at her. But it's like, but that is as much of a stretch as the other theories.
Well, the only thing is, then it's like, it has to be so meticulously planned out to the point where he would almost have like some kind of protection to stop blood from getting onto his clothes that he then disposes of before, like perfectly, so that the police can't find it, no one notices it.
Yeah.
So he'd have to put that on, kill her, take it off, dispose of it, and emerge from the house seemingly without change.
Right.
In that time.
So normally in these things I'm going with, and this is what I was thinking early on when I started looking into this, was I would normally go with the kind of Occam's razor thing of like, well, the simplest explanation and the most statistically likely explanation is that he killed her because he's in her family and close to her. But then the more things we have, the more layers we have to add to make it possible for him to do it, it that falls down. And now it's not anywhere near the simplest explanation. But I think this is why, I think the short period of time is why the prosecution have gone with these are the same clothes for the purposes of the case, because it's already such a small window. You can't, like, you couldn't, there's just simply not enough time for you
it
to...
It takes me 3 minutes to get changed normally.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even if, like, even if you sent me to get changed, the quickest I could possibly get changed would probably be a minute.
Yeah.
Like a whole minute. If you were like, this is an emergency, get changed right now, a whole minute it would still take me, I think.
Mm.
And that leaves you only 2 minutes. Like, that's 120 seconds to get mad about something, start beating your foster daughter until she dies or is close to death with a tent peg, and then without changing anything about yourself, like, get out of the house and go.
And if you have changed clothes, you know, they didn't find these clothes elsewhere. They didn't, it was like he had a washing machine on.
So I do think it's a weak case against him, and that you should need more before you put someone away for life for something like this. You don't have a situation comparable to like Lorraine Thorpe and Paul Clark from episode 3, where they're telling their mates and police what they've done and then laughing in court. So you're going to need more evidence for me to believe that Sean Jenkins is guilty.
Yeah.
A website set up by supporters of Sean Jenkins details a lot of what they call unanswered questions in the case, many of these raised in the retrials. If you want to have a look at that, it is called www.justiceforseanjenkins.org.uk, and just a reminder that it's spelled, Sean is spelled S-I-O-N. The website accuses the police of inaction over other possible lines of inquiry. The unanswered questions they list include an allegation that Mr. B's alibi was later found to be unreliable and that this has not been followed up. That the police repeatedly stated they were satisfied Mr. B was not the attacker but could not explain why publicly. The connection between Mr. B and Billy Joe's body through the plastic bag piece. The piece of plastic was very deeply lodged inside the nose, and such a deliberate act could only be explained by someone experiencing some kind of delusion, according to this group. The sudden and brutal murder taking place in just 3 minutes by Sean Jenkins, as we said, is unconvincing, and the introduction of the piece of plastic would have added more time.
Yeah.
Even if it could be logically linked to Sean, which it couldn't. There's no explanation as to why he would do that.
Yeah, exactly.
The police dismissed other witnesses that gave versions of events that didn't suit the narrative that Sean Jenkins was the killer, according to this website. The website also goes into a lot of detail about other aspects of the case, including throwing doubt on Lois Jenkins' statements about Sean. So check that out if you are interested for that side of the story. But the outcome of the retrials, I think rightfully for the reasons that we've outlined over the last, I don't know, recently, was that Sean's conviction was deemed unsafe. And we came across that term a couple of episodes ago. Basically, it was decided that the prosecution didn't prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury were unable to reach a verdict in both retrials, despite deliberating for multiple days. The judge decided not to go ahead with a third retrial, and the result of that is that Sean was released on bail. In 2006, he was acquitted completely of the murder of Billie Joe Jenkins. He had spent 6 years in jail. Another suspect in the case has never come up. In the eyes of the law, at least, Billie Joe's murderer remains unidentified and her case is cold and unsolved. I say another suspect has never come up, I mean besides the ones that we've spoken about, right, officially.
Okay. I wasn't expecting him to be out and about.
He remarried and he now lives in Bath. Bath is a place. I just wanted to say that in case, because we've got some funny place names in England. But yeah, Bath is a place. Mm. It's in Somerset. Billie Joe is buried in East London. She's buried with her father, Bill Jenkins, who died in 2006.
That's an interesting choice.
It is. It is interesting.
But I guess we know so little about that relationship that...
Sean Jenkins has responded to journalists saying that he has continued to speak to witnesses and even in the last few years and is keen to uncover new evidence that could lead to Billie Joe's killer. So this isn't like... So I guess you could say this isn't like an OJ situation where he's like, oh yeah, I'm going to find the real killer and then he does nothing. Like this guy is involved still. Like he is sort of still looking for the real killer, supposedly. Before we wrap up the episode, I wanted to ask, although we've been talking about it for a while, what you think, having heard about the verdicts, the evidence, do you think that someone else could have done this, and what do you think to the innocence or guilt of Sean Jenkins?
It's so hard to say, because as you were saying, it's like it seems like it would make sense for him to be the killer, but just reasonably, I don't know how that's possible. But then this whole shopping trip is just insane. There's no way it can't be an alibi. Do you know what I mean?
I know, like, I'm sorry, I'm laughing. I feel like I'm laughing a lot, but I'm laughing because of the absurdity of it, where it's like, you just think that has to be an alibi, right? That's the most bizarre thing ever. But
that is but the strangest thing.
I guess he could just be the absolute unluckiest guy.
He could just be like the most absent-minded person as well.
Yeah, where he's made like this series of decisions that just look so suspicious but could be nothing. And it's, I don't know, it's such a bizarre thing.
I'm trying to figure out how this shopping trip makes sense either way. Like in the sense, if we take it as like it's a legitimate trip and it's not an alibi, at what point does he decide to go to the shops to get white spirit, come back into the house presumably to either notice that he needs white spirit or that he needs money, leave the house without any money, knowing that he's leaving the house to go to the shops... go to the shops and leave with nothing.
It's so
and
bizarre.
Then drive around a park twice.
You get that point and you're like, oh, he definitely did it. But then you're like, 3 minutes? How? Yeah. It's just not possible. And there's a microscopic mist of blood that you can't even see with your own eyes. I can't buy that. It's really bizarre. I would love to know what other people think about this because I just literally can't arrive at a conclusion. I can't.
The other thing is that it's like in the other theory that it's an intruder, as we were saying, it doesn't make sense for someone to break into someone's house with the intent of killing someone without their own murder weapon, or it's extremely rare. There are cases where that happens, obviously. But any sort of attempt at making that theory logic just goes against the sort of unpredictable nature of the fact that their primary suspect is a person with mental illness.
Mm.
And therefore you can't necessarily try and apply
rational thinking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then in that theory, he has to be smart enough and in a clear enough state of mind to avoid being seen or caught after committing this act. So it's not a totally irrational, mindless killing. But then the plastic bag, what's that about? I'm just so confused.
I'm glad to have brought you in to feel the way I've been feeling for the last like 5 days or whatever that I've been looking into this.
Because I was almost thinking, because I originally thought that the plastic could have gone up her nose as someone tried to put a bag over her head and tried to like suffocate her. It's too far up for that to be possible.
It's so deliberate that it's bizarre. And that's why the defense say it has to be someone who has some kind of delusion about plastic bags or something and has to introduce it that way. Right. But there's all this stuff out there on Mr. B and his plastic bag fixations and what this was about, how what extent it was sexual, to what extent it was not. It was like a delusion. But he was found when they arrested him. He had a plastic bag and he was like cradling it, and he had plastic bag in his underwear and things like that. So it was definitely a big thing for him.
Right.
And he was said to have an interest in covering things like holes and gaps with plastic bags. So I don't know if this is a hole being covered, the logic there, but that's something. Interestingly, to say that when Mr. B is arrested, he has a plastic bag with him. That plastic bag is blue, not a black bin liner like the one that was in her nose.
That's the other thing. I don't know if someone who's got such a specific fixation would necessarily consider a bin liner a plastic bag.
Do you want to share something with the room? Are you into?
I'm just saying, if you're so specifically into plastic bags.
Yeah.
A bin liner is a sort of different category. For me, they're in the same category, but it's not something you would go shopping with.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And it's a slightly different plastic, even, maybe. It's a thicker plastic.
It is a different plastic, you're right.
So I don't know how this guy thinks.
I love that you're trying to rationalize it, though. If I was into plastic bags, I wouldn't be into bin bags. That would be a step too far.
And then my other question was, did they not find any fingerprints whatsoever on this murder weapon?
This is a thing that I did think about that as well. They didn't seem to find any other DNA evidence, because if they had, you know, we would have probably had a solution by now. Mm. If they'd have found the DNA of someone who wasn't Sean in this vicinity, then we would know there's someone else. And it's possible that they do know that and they're keeping it close to their chest for some reason. But we don't know that. And there's no fingerprints, because obviously if Sean was fingerprinted and there were fingerprints on the tent peg and they were his fingerprints, that would obviously have come up at trial, as opposed to this mist of blood that is so tenuous.
Well, yeah, that would have come up, but then it also would have just been like, yeah, this is my house and that's my possession.
Yeah, but you would think they'd be in the blood kind of thing. So yeah, so we can assume that. But it's 1997 when the case is, when this happens and the case is processed. So we don't know how, like, how different it would be now in terms of what we could collect and what we could know. So a couple of recent events before we finish. In 2012, the so-called M25 rapist, Anthony Imiela, I could be saying that wrong, but that's how I'm going to say it, was linked to the murder of Billy Joe. This guy preyed on girls around Billy Joe's age and openly stated his preference for 13-year-olds. He is now known to have committed attacks as early as 1987, although he is most known for attacks between 2001 and 2002, I think. He lived near the home of the family, and he was said to match a description given of someone supposedly stalking the area. He was known to lie in wait for victims to be in a position where they could be attacked, and detectives in Billy Joe's case have theorized that an attacker could have potentially hidden in wait for Billy Joe to be alone. The part of the bin bag found in Billy Joe's nose could also loosely be connected, because Anthony Imiela had placed a bin bag over the head of one of his victims. However, there was no evidence that Billy Joe had been raped, as Imiela's victims had been. So yeah.
I
don't find that convincing, because I feel that he would have raped her.
Yeah, I think so too. And if this is one of his first offences, I don't know if he'd go straight to murder.
Yes, agreed. In 2017, the 20th anniversary of the murder, Debbie, Billy Joe's birth mother, called for the case to be reopened. In the same year, the police had confirmed that they were not actively investigating, and it was reported that the unsolved murder had remained unexamined for more than 10 years.
I will say there does seem, I don't know if it's just that they're being careful with their information as well, but it does seem like the police aren't particularly involved in this case.
It kind of seems like they don't have a lot and that they're not, and that, I mean, so this guy's been acquitted. I know they believe it was him, the Sean.
Yeah.
But you'd think you'd be, okay, boots on the ground, we've got to sort out what actually happened then. But it's not really like that.
When he was arrested, it seems like, you know, there are all these sort of rumours going about that there was someone stalking her and they don't seem to really care. They're sort of like, well, we couldn't find anything, so doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I guess. I don't want to go too hard on them just because we don't know what information they could have found. But then there is all these accusations of people coming to them and saying things and them going, that doesn't matter. Yeah. so yeah, you're, I mean, it's definitely a question. Police said they had received no new information since 2006 that could justify working on the case actively. Debbie said, it would be great if they could open the investigation again and get some fresh eyes on it. I can't describe it to you unless you have lost a child. It's a nightmare. I want to get justice for her. And Debbie has said, I mean, as any mother would, she'd never gotten over it. I mean, this is a girl that she allowed to be in someone else's care. So obviously she must feel horrible about it all. The detective who originally headed the investigation, Jeremy Payne, is now retired. He said, Billie Jo would be coming up to 34 now and could have had her own family. I'm sure that periodically police will be looking again at this case to see if new techniques in forensic science can provide more evidence. So that's it for the case of Billie Jo Jenkins and this episode of A Podcast About Murder. There is a lot out there on this case, more than I realized there would be ever. So if I've missed anything, it could be on purpose for brevity, or it could be because I just didn't see it. But I would encourage people to look this up and keep this alive because it's still unsolved. And you can find a lot of detail out there. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We are at About Murder on Twitter, at A Podcast About Murder on Instagram, and facebook.com/apodcastaboutmurder with no E. You can also search for us on YouTube. Help us out by subscribing. Rate the podcast where you listen if you can. Always a good idea, but only if you liked it. Don't rate it if you didn't like it. We're not worth it. All right. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
Have a good weekend.